Welcome to The Dream Show. I'm Jane Teresa Anderson, and this is episode 238-238. And if you're listening to this in real time, we are on the last day of 2020. Or if you're in America, you may be listening to it straight off the bat on the 30th of December, but pretty close to the end of the year, and of course, what a year it's been. Our guest today is Edie, and Edie is from an island off the coast of Panama. And as you know, we broadcast from Tasmania, which is an island state off the south coast of Australia. So we're bringing you something pretty special to end the year, island to island across the world. And as you also know, if you're a regular listener to the show, when we have a guest on the show, the guest remains anonymous. And that is so that we can delve deeply into the dream. And, you know, the person keeps confidentiality and we can go where we need to go. Occasionally, a guest will say, no, I'm actually happy for you to know who I am because there's a good reason for me to do this. And you'll hear as we go that Edie does that. In fact, she's written a book, and you'll find the link to the book in the accompanying blog that goes with this, or the show notes that go with this podcast. So Edie comes on, and as you also know, if you regularly listen to the show, I know nothing about the dream until we start recording, and it usually is one dream. But there's a very good reason for Edie to actually introduce three dreams in this one. So I'm going to leave you hanging on that knife edge. And the show is a little bit different, and I know that you're going to really enjoy it. You're going to love it. So just before we go there, a reminder of the website addresses. My main website, janeteresa.com. That's Teresa without an H. That's where you can go to listen to every episode of The Dream Show that's ever been, although you can also listen to The Dream Show with Jane Teresa Anderson on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all the other usual podcast listening platforms. Also at janeteresa.com, you can read hundreds of blogs on dreams and dreaming. You can find out how to consult me privately about your own dreams. You can find out about my books. I'm the author of 7 books. You can find out what they are and how to get them. And you can also link through to my Dream Academy, which is where you go if you want to learn about how to interpret your own dreams, or even take courses on how to become a dream therapist, a professional dream therapist. Or you can go straight to that learning platform, the Dream Academy. The address is dream-academy-online.com. But more importantly than all of that, let's go on to Edie. Welcome to The Dream Show, Edie.
Ah, thank you for inviting me. Thank you for listening.
It's a pleasure. And I do know, although I don't know anything about your dreams, Edie, I do know that it's island to island day, because here we are. I am sitting in Tasmania, which is an island on the as far south as you can get into in Australia, and next up is the Antarctica, and you are on an island near or in Panama.
Yes, I'm about 35 miles out into the Pacific Ocean from Panama City.
Isn't it wonderful that we can both sit on little islands and basically talk to everyone in the world?
It is amazing, isn't it? It's lovely. It opened up the world. That's one thing the internet's done for us, for sure.
So as you know, Edie, I know nothing about what you're going to bring today, what dream you're going to bring. So you begin.
Okay. Well, let's see. The dreams have been very influential in my life. But then I've had to interpret them by myself, right? Some of them I've been so sure of what the message is. So a lot of them bring messages that I'd like to discuss some of those with you. And there's kind of a twist to it, because when I was a child, I had imaginary friends, like a lot of kids do. And in this case, my imaginary friends showed up in dreams. And I have names for them because they have very distinct personalities. One of them I call Wonder Woman, because she's kind of a warrior, avenger spirit. The other one is like more of a passive, I call her the nun. Okay?
Yes.
And so some of these, I've got about 7 dreams, but each one, I can definitely tell who it is. So it's almost like a spirit. So, and I've tried to study dreams and figure out what's the difference between a vision, a prophetic dream, a blah, blah, blah. I've never been able to figure it out. So I'm just delighted to be on the show with you. Maybe we can figure some of that out.
It's lovely, and I look forward to that. Have you any idea whether they started as imaginary friends first and then you dreamed about them? Or have you any idea whether they appeared in the dreams first and then they became your imaginary friends? I suppose it's pretty hard to remember back to being six to answer that question.
Well, I think they came to me as characters, and it was only afterwards that I gave them their title of the Wonder Woman and the Nun.
So they came to you in dreams first?
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. It was only afterwards, and particularly when I started to write a book about that journey, that I started to identify the strong personalities in the dream. So the visions came first. And they weren't always, I call one of them Wonder Woman, for instance, and the other one the Nun. I think I told you that. But they're not always women. They're not always, but I always recognize them.
So
whatever they look like.
They're like an energy rather than a male or a female, and you've latterly put names on them.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, I'd say that's probably true.
So when you say there were a vision when you were six, you mean you had a sense of them while you were awake or only in dreams?
Only in dreams.
Only in dreams, yeah.
I don't know if that's the case with all of them, but certainly the one when I was in six, the one that made a big impression. And it was the dream itself. It was because I had a dog. It was actually my brother's dog, but he was my companion, and he was my lassie, okay?
Yes.
Everybody has a lassie. He was my lassie. His name was Blackie. And the environment I was in was very dysfunctional and a lot of violence. So I kind of... that's the environment I came from. And this particular dream, how it opens up is that there's a there's like a boxing match, with the lines that go around and delineate the area and the seating back from the area, and you're looking up at the arena, and there's the lights glaring down, and they are spotlighting the hardwood floor. I remember seeing, you know how lights play on wood?
Yes.
To show that. And then, so there was a fight going on. And what I remember about the fight is that the wrong person won. I didn't like who won. So I sicked my dog on the boxer that won. And I remember that my dog was a big black and white sheepdog, big long hair, wonderful dog. And I remember him jumping up into that ring, and his nails are trying to get a grip on that hardwood floor, and he's slipping, and he's getting enraged, and all of a sudden he's slobbering out of the sides of his mouth. And then the scene changes. Instead of ropes around the ring, there's doors around the ring, and the boxer that he's after is running through one door and out the other, and my dog is chasing him. He's going to get him.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, out of the sky or the ceiling or whatever, comes this figure, and it's a man, looks like a doctor. He's got the doctor white down on,
yeah.
And he's got the stethoscope around his neck, and I don't remember exactly, he spoke to me, I don't remember the exact words now, but he made it clear that I was turning a good dog into a vicious tool, that I was turning the dog's loyalty into something vile, and it was my fault. I was destroying my best friend, my protector. And from that day on, here's 6 years old, from that day on, I never sicked that dog on anyone else. It made that big of an impression on me.
Mm. It's amazing, isn't it, how and how we can take something literally from a dream, and it can affect us that strongly that we'll, even though the dog was most likely symbolic, you then took forward that your actual real dog you were never going to set on anybody, which is probably a good thing.
Yes, I'm sure it was, and you know, to a child, it was. I didn't doubt. It never occurred to me to doubt. Well, that was weird, or how could that possibly happen? It was like, yes. You know. It was just like an adult talking to me. Totally accepted that this was being told to me.
And in the dream, that felt good that he was telling you that in the dream? Can you remember, you know, whether it was just when you woke up and you thought, that's right, or was there a sense in the dream of, okay, no, I'll be okay if I don't let my dog do this again?
Yes, I felt that this was just the proper way to act. It was like, you know, and I accepted that. Mm. So that was like, okay, you know, that's not good. I didn't feel bad, but I would have felt bad. I definitely would have felt bad if I'd ever done it. Now that I knew, it was like I understood that I didn't know.
Yes.
What I was doing. But now that I did know what I was doing, I definitely realized if I'd have done that, I would have been in my own mind, in a child's mind, I would have been a bad person if I'd have continued to do that.
Was there any sense, looking back, do you know, did you kind of take forward another lesson from that in terms of not biting back to people that you were upset? Did you find yourself softer or looking for healing ways of resolving conflict? Or did you, like most children... still lose the plot when somebody was upsetting or abusive towards you?
Well, you know, when I look back and I label that as the nun spirit that was trying to write. But no, that because then there are other dreams where it was the Wonder Woman who is like, okay, no, I'm now the Avenger. So no, I didn't stop being an Avenger. I just stopped ruining my dog. The lesson wasn't if there was a lesson that I was supposed to be, you know, not bite back throughout my life, I didn't get it. I didn't get that.
We are all such amazingly complex and beautiful human beings, you know, so we all have many aspects to ourselves, as you've beautifully demonstrated there. You know, there's the potentially healing, because he was a doctor, the potentially healing nun spirit, as you call her. There's also the Avenger, you know, there's all the different aspects of ourselves that throughout our lives, let alone at the age of 6, are often in conflict and have to find ways to come to terms with each other, or you know, resolve things within ourselves that then reflect in the outer world. So I think, you know, this particular dream was looking at that particular aspect. But a thing that really struck me, and it's going to be really hard, Ed, looking back to, you know, so many years, to think, well, how were you feeling at the time, or what happened immediately before the dream? So, you know, usually we're looking at, well, your dream was last week, so what was happening the week before then? It's much fresher. But even so, I really noticed that you mentioned the floor a couple of times there. You know, the spotlight was on the hardwood floor. So even in the dream, the hardwood floor was important, but the spotlight was doubly really focusing on, look at this hardwood floor. And then later, when your dog was running after the winning boxer, you noticed that he was trying to grip on the hardwood floor. So there's this constant, this is going back to looking at the floor or the hardwood floor. Is there any way that you can think, looking back, what did you have hardwood floors when you were 6?
I think that probably relates to the fact that my father, who was an abuser, was a wrestling champion. So I think that I was relating that to a gym floor.
Ah.
To an arena.
Yes. So that's most probably absolutely correct. You know, other ways around that may be that there may be something that happened on or near a floor that you really took on board as a symbol in your dream, or there may have been a sense that the 6-year-old in there was always looking for some kind of grounding, or, you know, let me just focus on the floor and everything will be okay, let me feel the floor below my feet, or that's, as I say, the opposite, that something did happen and it's like your dreaming mind is going, well, what happened on the hardwood floor? Let's, you know, so we will never know that, but I'm just noticing that it was mentioned twice. And, you know, you say your father was a wrestler. This is a boxing match, so it's a little bit different. There's a bit of a change here. And you particularly described the boxing match quite accurately, as, you know, you said it was delineated. And so we all get that feeling of the four lines that we all know, you know, the four ropes that form the square around the boxing arena.
Right.
And when we think of boxes, even though you can get round boxes, I guess when we think of boxes, we think of square boxes as well. So there was something in the way that you said the boxing match and delineated, it all felt very, and then maybe the hardwood floor too. There's no softness in any of that. It's straight lines, delineation, rules and regulations, something hard going on, maybe something along those lines. And then what's really lovely is that when you, even though you set your dog on the boxer, there was a point where the ropes opened up to doors. So, you know, for me, listening in on that six-year-old dream, there's a sense of something that was delineated in hard ways actually opened up to opportunity in some way, you know, ropes opened up to doors. And even though your dog was still was still chasing and after some kind of avenge, in a dog-like biting way, there was still a sense that for the six-year-old child, you were perhaps looking for a way out, you know, where are the opportunities in this? And one of the opportunities that came to your six-year-old mind, and I have to put in parenthesis in here that no matter how many little children's dreams I listen to, I'm always in an absolute state of awe at their sophistication about what they're processing about life and about what's going on. You know, our understanding in dreams as a small child is, it seems to be infinitely wiser than what we can relate to and understand while we're awake. And you've got that sense in your dream of the doctor, you know, who should be the healing aspect, maybe particularly because he's in white. So there's that sense of you as an inner child going, what is healing for me? How can I come to terms with there's been a conflict in my life which feels like a boxing match? It's around delineation, rules, regulation, hardness. And I'm really frightened about this. The wrong person is winning. You know, things aren't turning out the way that they should. And yet in your dream, there's a sense of, yeah, maybe there's an opportunity. Maybe there's an opening here. There's something that can be achieved here. And that's where the doctor comes in. So even at the age of six, there's maybe some kind of feeling of maybe I can heal this. Maybe I can turn this around. And maybe I can turn it around by setting my dog. And then the doctor says, well, actually, you know, that's actually not the way to do it. There are probably better ways to do it. So it's kind of like a maybe phase one dream where you're beginning to think, okay, maybe the best thing in life, maybe even though I'm only six and something awful has happened to me and I need to sort out this conflict and I need to address it and I need to be the winner or I need to resolve this, maybe there's a softer way to do it. Maybe I'm opening to looking for a way to resolve this in some sense.
I definitely think it was a matter of my trying to figure out how to win in whatever I thought this fight was. So,
and it's interesting, isn't it? Like from a child's point of view, as you say there, it was how to win. It wasn't how to negotiate a settlement. It wasn't how to come to terms. It wasn't how to understand the situation and find a third path. It was about winning. So, you know, maybe that set your psyche at age six, which is normal for a six-year-old. How do I win this battle?
In the world I was in, that's what I saw is the strongest in the world were winning.
Yeah.
And it was a constant fight, and he who was the strongest won the fight. And so I was looking for, you know, how am I going to win? Well, I'll sick my dog on him. That would be one way. But oh no, you know, that's not what you want. So
you mentioned that the dog was your loyal companion. Did you say something about loyalty?
Oh yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
So on a deeper level, Ed, maybe there's a sense there of don't put your loyalty out on the line. That's not the way to do it.
Yes. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I definitely internalized that as don't hurt, don't use somebody else. Don't hurt that dog.
Become responsible for yourself. But there's also a way to look at dreams where you look at everyone or everything in a dream as representing something about yourself. And so you could then say that the dog maybe represented your inner companion, your inner loyalty, your sense of loyalty. And there's something there, as you say, with the dream, with setting the dog onto the bad guy. I guess the fear was that the dog would be hurt. So there may have been a sense there of trying to protect your loyalty to yourself.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's probably what the spirit was trying to tell me in a way that I could understand it as a child, you know, for heaven's sakes, don't hurt this loyal dog. But maybe the spirit was trying to show me that I was hurting my own soul by that approach.
Yeah.
Those are the type of dreams I've had all through my life. That type.
Have they always involved wanting to be the winner, or has there come a point where some of the dreams there's been a resolution of some kind?
Let me think. Well, there's I remember when I was particularly confused in my 20s over a moral dilemma. So it wouldn't have been a matter of winning there. It would have been a matter of, but when I look at it, I could see the correlation between trying to figure out the right way to be, whatever the right way is.
Yes.
So in my 20s, it was a moral dilemma, and the dream, it was like a gypsy, an old, weathered, hag type of gypsy, and you know, not necessarily rags, because it didn't look like she was destitute. She looked like she was a sage. Mm-hmm. Okay, an old, weathered gypsy hat, and she's sitting cross-legged on a hard-baked sand in the desert, in the high desert. For some reason, I related it to the high desert.
Mm.
And before her, she held an old fruit jar with a rusty old top. And inside was all these folded up pieces of paper. You know how when you have a jar full of pieces of paper and you pick out a winner? You know,
yes.
This was her, but I was looking for an answer to a right or wrong moral dilemma. And she didn't say anything. She just shook up the jar. She unscrewed that rusty top, and she scattered the contents before me on the earth. And immediately she looked up at me as if to say, "There's no one single answer. Take your pick."
That is fantastic. Did the dream end there?
Yeah.
I love it. Absolutely love it. So,
to me, the message was, you know, stop looking for that one answer. You're not going to, you know. But then I was like 23 in that time.
Well,
I've had several dreams, but that
you were definitely sage by the end of 23, because that was a very good bottom line. and given that, you know, going on the idea that everyone in a dream represents something about you, at the age of 23, there was this sage, or what we've all got a sage wise part, but, you know, it may manifest in different ways in our dreams. And when you were 23, you saw the sage part of yourself as gypsy old, so you saw your wisdom as an ancient wisdom, I guess.
Yes, that's the way it felt.
Did you notice, though, it was interesting that she was sitting on the hard baked sand again, so there's that reference to something hard on the ground again.
Yes, again, it's like a hard life.
Yes,
it's like a hard reality.
A hard reality, even hard baked. You said it was hard baked sand. What does hard baked mean to you?
Well, when you bring that out, I think about the book. Okay, the book. The title of the book, and I'll share it with the audience. It's How Wonder Woman Became a Smuggler.
Yeah.
So in that title itself, we're talking about a very hard baked life.
Yes.
And hard-won lessons. So, but that's what this dream is. And then when I was in 65, I had a dream about a wolf pack. And again, it's the hard-baked life dream again. Interesting. I had never related the hard floor to the hard desert. Sand. Not, it wasn't sand. It was baked hard. And then in the wolf dream, it's, you know, the classic family of tattered wolves looking at each other in, you know, cloudy sky and the moon, and they're desolate, but they're enduring. And so, I mean, and that's in 68. So there we go. Well, that's like from 6 to 68, there's that one theme. I had never noticed that before.
No, it's very interesting, isn't it? At 68, the emotion of that, you did mention the sky there, so we were looking a bit higher up, but they were still on the ground. And the emotion of the wolves that you mentioned there was desolate but enduring. Do you feel when you were 68, was that the kind of emotion that was around you at that time, desolate but enduring?
Yeah, it was. There was a big breakup in the family, and it was interesting the way that dream started, because it was two very contrasting scenes. And the in one, I'm a white toy poodle, and I'm running through the bright green manicured lawn on a Sunday morning, ears flapping, pink tongue, a well taken care of, and a happy pet. All of a sudden, the scene changes. The moon is barely visible. It's peeking out from behind moving dark clouds. And there on the forest floor, it's a family of wolves gathered in a circle, and they're howling at the moon. They're desolate. They're matted gray coats, kind of matching to the blue-black sky, but they're enduring. So they're not predators, but it's a hard reality that it's... I didn't like that dream at all. I went to great extent to try to figure out if there were other things that the wolves could mean besides that kind of, oh my God, right?
You know, lots of interesting, and I can appreciate you didn't like it. I love it now that we're sitting far into the future and looking back on it. Note, first of all, how, you know, your dog dream when you were six, and now we're looking at the white poodle and the wolves, all of which are kind of dog-like. So this dog theme may have stayed with you for a long time too, and your one line of questioning could have been, my six-year-old inner dog was maybe my loyal companion or represented my loyalty. And how has that evolved across all these dreams and across the years of my life? And at 68, it would appear, wouldn't it, that there's two dogs, there's two EDs here, as not as in schizophrenic, we've all got multifacets to our personalities, but it's possible that the waking life one, you know, the one that you presented to the world in general, was probably more like the white toy poodle. Here I am, everything's lovely, all the lawns are manicured, I'm happy, I'm clean, I've been, you know, cut and brushed or whatever you do to toy poodles. Life is wonderful.
Yes.
But on the underside, deep down inside, on the unconscious, in the unconscious, or maybe just subtly felt within you, on the shadow side, what you didn't really want people to see, and we all have this, was not so much the toy poodle as the desolate but enduring wolf. But it was nice, you know, one thing that was nice, even though they were on the hard floor, was that there was more than one wolf, which of course there normally are, it's a pack, but they were in a circle. So we've gone from, if we're going to do this massive sweep of looking at a dream theme over a few decades, we can almost say, I wonder whether the square delineated box of the boxing dream when you were six had become, by age 68, the circular, even though it was a scary dream, had become more of a circle. There was a softness, even though it was hard, there was a softness. Even though it was desolate, there was an enduring quality. Something had come in here.
More family.
More family, yes. More
The wolves were definitely a family, and when I was six, it was, I only saw it as just me. Of course, that's the way kids feel.
Yes, that's right. So this, you see, not only how you relate to people in the outer world, but also, I guess, bringing your inner family together. You know, there's more to me than meets the eye. There are more ways to deal with this boxer than to send my one and only dog out. There are other ways to do this. And I love the fact
at least I didn't send the wolf pack after people. That's good.
Yeah. And I guess that's the thing, Edie, you know, you didn't send the wolf pack after people, which was a great thing, but you acknowledged it. So if you translate that into possible language, there were times in my life when I was 68 where I really could have snarled and howled and in my desolation really snapped at a few people, but I didn't. I kept it underground, I kept it in my shadows. And if you only got that far and I kept it in my shadows, it could have been not the best contributor to the way life went, because it could be an emotion that you were keeping down that would nevertheless, like all things in the unconscious, been extremely powerful and had its howl in some way or another. But if, on the other hand, you take an awareness of that shadow side, which I'm sure you did at the time, an awareness of there is a wolf pack within me, then in any situation where you want to howl at something that's happening out there, you might have then appreciated that let's take this to the inner family of wolves, let's calm this down, let's soften this, let's negotiate how we can come to a resolution with this rather than go straight out and bite. But as with all these things, you know, it's the waking life aspect of an issue and the unconscious shadow aspect of the issue that need to come to terms. So if you had come to me with that dream now and we'd spent an hour looking at it, which we're obviously not spending an hour, I might have suggested at the end something like, while it was still a current issue for you, something like doing a dialogue on paper between the white toy poodle and one of the wolves, and got them to, you know, and write it really, really quickly, so your storytelling mind and your editing mind and your conscious self didn't come into it, and you just let your unconscious mind just run loose, and you give the dog and the wolf each about just a few words, chat to each other, and you'd start with something like the white toy poodle saying, "Oh, I'm having a lovely day today, the sun's shining. Oh, who are you?" And the wolf would go, "Oh." And anyway, this conversation would just go. And usually when you do that, when you're dealing with dream figures at the time of the dream, and you just let them go and your unconscious mind is going, it will often, not always, but often find a resolution. So in other words, the toy poodle and the wolf might actually come to an agreement about something. And when you do that, it's a form of dream alchemy. It has this really amazing, it produces this amazing inner shift where the two aspects of yourself become more aligned and more open to healing, that the wolf acknowledges the emotions and sensibilities and beliefs of the white toy poodle and vice versa, and they join forces in a way which is more healing. And I don't know what that would be, but that would be
so it doesn't have to be one or the other.
It doesn't have to be one or the other, and it doesn't have to be holding that shadow side down. Yeah, so, well, in your imagination right now, without thinking about it too hard, what might the white toy poodle and one of those wolves, what resolution or way of working together might they come to?
I can't, you know, the white toy poodle, it just seems like is of course living in the moment, but only on the surface. It doesn't really understand what the strength of that the wolf has, the endurance that the wolf has. So I'm not seeing what they have a lot in common. I'd probably have to dream that through to see what kind of a conversation they would have. You know, interestingly enough, about 3 years after that dream, I was down in Mexico speaking, because I had a business going in having to do with medical in Mexico. And I walked into someone's bedroom in Los Algodones, a little hovel type of thing, and it was like deja vu. The wolf dream was, and it was because in the bed was this, and this is not a dream, this is a reality. It was like a well-worn, I would say, man and his wife under a quilt in their bed, and they had the baby was sitting on their duvet, if you want to call it that. And the guy's hair was so matted and gray, it was just in the whole walls were like it was just a hovel is what it was. But his gray hair was falling around his pillow, but his wife's arm was over him, and so there was some comfort there. It was the endurance. What I saw was that wolf pack endurance in that family. And I thought, well, maybe it's empathy. Maybe it's maybe that dream gave me empathy of what people go through and their endurance when they can rely upon family.
Yes.
When those wolves were relying upon family, the little toy poodle. It wasn't the little toy poodle didn't really have a family. It was well taken care of, but the wolves are a family of wolves. They have community. That's
yes.
interesting.
Yes, it is interesting, isn't it? So it may have been that the arrangement that the wolves and the toy poodle may have come to could have been something like the wolves would occasionally come onto the manicured lawn and be part of the white poodle's family, or offer support to a family, or take her on a journey to find other toy poodles that she can relate to and have as family. And they might have taught the white poodle to have some empathy for their lives as the wolves. And they might have...
Or maybe just given the toy poodle a family. The toy poodle didn't know what she was missing.
Yes, yes.
But she didn't have a family.
Yes. So it's
that could have been it.
Yes, beautiful. So it's playing with those, and particularly when the dreamer, which is you, comes up with a solution, which is the way it should be, which is give the toy poodle a family. So there'd be that sense then that, you know, maybe the part of yourself that was going, look, no, nothing, you know, I'm absolutely fine, life is wonderful, everything's manicured, everything's perfect, look at my curls, look, I've just been to the toy poodle hairdresser, you know, life
know
is great.
That's obvious, isn't it?
It is. But give that energy, as you say, give that energy, support and family. And she too may soften. She may say, well, maybe I don't need these curls. Maybe I can throw some wild flowers on my lawn. Maybe it doesn't need to be manicured. Maybe I'd rather live in a forest, in the desert. You know. So it was the idea of then maybe transformation in your world in situations where you did tend to come out as the toy poodle, where you might, if you'd had support around you, family support, not chosen family, not blood necessarily blood family. If you had that support, you might have softened and you know, moved a little bit along the line towards the wolf. You know, not the total grey matted hair thing, but somewhere
without
along
the
there.
Matted hair. Yeah, exactly. And I didn't get the impression that the poodle was uncaring or. You know, I didn't get the impression that poodle would look thought her life was all that, you know, and the wolves had less of a life.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't see. I just saw her as unaware.
Yeah. So
is all.
Although you were 68 at the time, would you have related to that idea that there was a part of yourself that was unaware and alone? And another part of yourself that wasn't?
Let's see. Well, I think that the white poodle routine was the dream that I thought that our family was achieving. Success, nice family, manicured lawn, what have you. The family broke up in dysfunction.
Yes.
So... that's undoubtedly where it was like, okay, we've gone from a family legacy to being poor,
mm-hmm.
because of family dysfunction. It's like having everything you've worked for, you realize, excuse me, you realize that... it's, you know, the disaster happens to a lot of people over a
yes.
lot of reasons, like these hurricanes. And so it was, I think it was having to give up on the manicured lawn and go for the endurance of the love within a family circle, even when things are really tough.
That's really lovely. That is so lovely. You know, as you say, you know, we all of us experience various crises, some bigger than others, though to each individual person, they will probably feel that they're the same size crisis. And they're awful at the time, but the wisdom and endurance and the change and the transformation that can come out of them, you know, converting that hardness to softness, that aloneness to family. So did you come out of, you know, the endurance that you managed to get there, and the moving away from the sense of the manicured, the letting, the surrendering, I guess, of the manicured lawn, the manicured, or the things that the family had represented, as you said.
Right.
Do you feel that you're in a better place now from going through that?
No, I wish I'd never had to go through it.
Ah.
but I think that you know, we don't always have that. We don't always have that we don't rarely have that choice. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that like even writing the book is very cathartic, and it's about self-awareness and healing. So, in the long run, it comes down to, well, what is the white manicured lawn in your mind? Mm-hmm. Is that the fancy cars? Is that the peace or peace of mind? What exactly is, you know, your what you relate to as a comfortable place to be?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's...
I love that.
Still working through it.
Yeah. We're all still working through it.
Yeah,
that is beautiful. I love it. So, in your book, would you like to speak a little bit more about your book? Because you've definitely fired up all of our interest in this.
Okay. Well, it is a story about. It's written as a biological novel. It's all based on true stories, and it's a coming of age all the way from 6 until. I ended the story in the 1990s, even though I could have gone on. Mm. I've had many adventures and what have you since then. But because I'm talking about real people in an epoch of time, once I was grown, then we're talking about the 70s and 80s. And so it's a journey of surviving domestic violence in your response to that, which is where the struggle comes between the Wonder Woman and the nun, is how you deal with you know, the different struggles.
Mm.
And gosh, it's just, you know, I had such amazing adventures, everything from working for a U.S. senator to being a Playboy bunny mother. I was a bunny mother. to being a court reporter in Key West, to being a part of a very extensive Ma and Pa marijuana smuggling group.
Wow. So well, that is
that's why it goes from all, you know, all those places. And,
yes.
You know, and it's, so I use nicknames for people who are definitely not only still alive, but some of them are still fugitives.
Yes.
But in other cases, I'm quoting from indictments, and so you know, it's very definitely based in time, in the days of when. Marijuana smuggling in the 70s and 80s was kind of a naive group of people. They were, you know, it was after the 60s, during the 60s sexual revolution, hence Playboy Club and what have you.
Yeah.
And and then the Vietnam War. And so you have all the defiance of that generation. And even though I was a little bit older than most of those generations, I never would have gotten into all those world if I hadn't have needed the escape routes that the black market provides.
Yes.
So I learned a tremendous, and I had a wonderful time, incidentally. I've never been freer than when I've been sailing and, you know, that type of thing. The dream that changed that life for me was, I don't know if I've got time, but it wasn't first of all a dream. It was an actual happening on a pier, where somebody way down the pier called after me, and they called me Lucifer, like they were trying to get my attention, Lucifer. And that's not my name. Something in me recognized it. And I turned around, and it was like, I don't feel that that's who I am. But here I am leaving a lifestyle that is actually doing the same thing I did to my dog, Blackie. I was, come to think of it, because people would follow me, and I never asked them to follow me. I never wanted anybody to follow me. But you influence people whether you want to or not.
Yeah.
And I was having such a wonderful time. And but all of a sudden, the people that I care about these people. They're ending up in jail. They're ending up addicted. And that guy calls me Lucifer. And then I had a dream afterwards. And I probably don't have time to go into that. But it was that dream that was like the Blackie thing that said, I don't care what you think that everybody should be able to do. This is, you know, but what you're doing is really hurting your friends and your family. You need to stop.
Yeah.
And so I stopped.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. And although we're not going into the dream, there's that double sense, isn't there, too? You know, well done on stopping. But it's that sense of not only is it hurting your friends and family, which you felt at the time, but it would also be hurting aspects of yourself.
Yeah, once I knew.
Once you knew, you know, yes.
Once I was no longer little Miss, what would you call it, ignorant, I suppose, Miss Magoo.
Little toy poodle.
Yes. It's like, okay, I can't do it. And you know, the same thing happened in Playboy Club, because I was a bunny mother.
Yeah.
And I have a background of working with girls, high-risk girls in juvenile court and all that type of thing. And I thought Playboy was fine in the, you know, in the 60s. It's where women were treated equally. Well, not quite. And once I found out what was really going on, you know, then I had to quit.
Yes.
It's like, oh, okay, this is not just, you know, this is this is not what you think it is. Oh my gosh.
Isn't it happened to me.
I said Blackie the dog has shown up lots of times in my
That's
life.
That's exactly right from the very beginning. And what's really lovely is that even though you would say there were times when you weren't aware of it, like being the bunny mother and thinking it was about empowerment for women and things.
That's right.
Even though all of that, Blackie lived on, and Blackie did after a while, you know, and you were listening. You were listening to those dreams. You were listening to the call of Lucifer, whatever it was. You were listening. And
yes.
So that informed your decisions that you made through, and gave you an amazing story to share in your book, which sounds absolutely fascinating. But
I'd be happy to send you a copy. We can talk about that later. Yeah,
I would love that. If you're happy, I'll put the blog associated with this podcast for people listening in. Can I put a link so that people can buy your book?
That'd be great. Do you need me to send you the link?
Yes, that'd be great. Thank you.
I can do that.
That'd be lovely.
I'd love that.
So what you've really so beautifully demonstrated here, Edie, as well as being a fabulous guest and telling a lovely story and also talking about your books, is this idea of, you know, whereas in the dream show, we usually take one dream and go into it very deeply for the whole 40, 45, 50 minutes and really strongly relate it to what's going on for the dreamer in their life now, and then are able to go, so knowing this about yourself, you know, what would you like to change? How does this change how you move from here? And we go that this has been different, but equally as informative, because it's taken a grand sweep over many years and found this Blackie theme going through, which is also an interesting synchronicity, because I wrote a put a blog out yesterday on one of my blog sites, which is the Dream Academy. And it was, I started writing it a few days before that, so I'm pretty sure you wouldn't have read it. But the blog was about just this. It's about how you can look back over your life. Instead of just looking at one dream, you can actually look back and go, oh, you know, I've often had dreams about this recurring dream thing. Not the kind of recurring dreams we all think about, like, yeah, you know, well, there's the teeth falling out or the being chased or the being cheated, you know, not the common dream themes, but that you can look back over your own life and say, in the example I gave, you know, there's often been a pathway in my dreams and the different things that have happened since, like you, I think the first dream I put in that blog, my blog's only a few paragraphs long, but the first dream I put in was one that I had at probably age 6 or 7, which featured a path and wolves as well.
A path and what?
And wolves.
Oh,
a wolf
really?
Pack, yeah.
Okay.
And then,
interesting.
And then I brought into the blog, you know, other dreams that I'd had in the 20s, my middle years, my later years, all featuring a pathway and taking the overview about how they'd sort of changed and about how you can almost look back over a dream theme and see the evolution or not of your dream theme. So I wrote that blog as this idea of reviewing a life and finding a dream theme. And
wow,
I'm pretty sure you haven't read
that. Don't you think that's eerie?
Yeah, it is. Happens to me all the time. But as listeners
amazing.
To this show will know,
that really is. Oh, isn't that interesting? Well, I
yes.
definitely want to read that. And that, but that's just yes.
So you've come into the show and beautifully illustrated that. So any, you know, people that are listening to this that probably have read that blog will go, oh, right, yes, yeah, now that brings that to life. And I'm glad Edie got in contact and asked to be on the Dream Show because she didn't know it, but she was going to go right in and illustrate this point that Jane Therese has just made.
That's right. That's but, amazing, really, truly.
More importantly than that, Edie, you've given people a lot to think about and looking at their own dreams. And you've also entertained us with your own story about your book, which I would truly encourage people to go out and get because, you know, it's we're your support family. We're part of your wolf
yes.
circle.
Yeah, well, there's a very definite, it's a lot of adventure, but there's a very definite serious undertone of the effect of a generational dysfunction, which is really the only reason I could bear to write it, because who, you know, I didn't want to, who cares about somebody else's particular story? I would never have told it if I didn't think that it might be helpful to some people.
Absolutely, you know, and while some people do write their own stories to be cathartic, as you mentioned earlier, I can see that's not what this is. And what I like about what I'm getting from your story here is that, yes, it was clear from the outset that it's a very deep book and it goes to some very dark places. But because you also bring in dreams, you know, anybody listening to this show can appreciate the power of bringing the dream work into something like that. And you know there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel. And what I also like, you know, speaking with you and listening to you tell the story of your book is your lightness and your humour. So we all know that the book is going to be dealing with tough stuff, but it's going to also give us doors, like the ropes around the boxing ring turning to doors. There's going to be softening, there's going to be doors, there's going to be openings, there's going to be messages we can all take from reading your book. And that's what dreams are about too, and sharing our dreams. So it sounds like it will be fantastic, and thank you for bringing it to the Dream Show.
Oh, you're more than welcome, and I'm just enthralled to, it's amazing that we've crossed paths, really. Isn't it amazing?
Island
it's like,
to island
talk
is.
About doors opening and what have you. Just writing this book has opened the door to where I would meet somebody like you. I just don't know what to do with all that. It's so amazing.
It's like me having the Dream Show and opens the doors to speaking to and meeting so many amazing people and
yes, I'll bet it does. I'll bet it does.
Yeah. Thank you.
What a wonderful way to live life.
It is.
Yeah.
Thank you. Have a beautiful evening.
All right. Thank you. You too.
That was fabulous, wasn't it? A couple of notes before we completely tie up. I did mention there at the end of our conversation that I'd written the blog about the recurring dream themes throughout life. Now, of course, although this episode of The Dream Show is going out on the last day of December. We actually recorded it in about the middle of November. So if you're looking for that blog, it's on the Dream Academy. So that's dream-academy-online.com. Go to the blog role, and it came out in mid-November. And I titled that blog, What's Your Recurring Dream Theme? And also, again, to give you Edie's book, her book is called How Wonder Woman Became a Smuggler. And as I've said, I'll put the link to that in the accompanying blog or show notes to this so that you can buy it. I'm sure it'll be on Amazon and all the usual places. So I also, other reminder of my other website address, janetereza.com. But really what I'm dying to say here is, if you're listening to this in real time, hey, we did it. We did 2020, and I'm wishing I'm wishing us all a happy and wonderful 2021. If you're listening to this way down the track, wonder how 2021 went. Our next episode of The Dream Show, episode 239, is due out on the 28th of January, 2021. Until then, have a wonderful new year, a wonderful January, and I know I'm speaking with some of you between now and then, and for everyone else, see you next time. I'm Jane Teresa Anderson.